two transgender Wisconsinites brought a federal lawsuit against the state's health department this week. They're alleging discrimination because their gender reassignment surgery is not covered by Wisconsin Medicaid. We're talking about the litigation, the politics, the climate surrounding being transgender in America today. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's start by bringing in Bruce Valmetti. He covers legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote a piece about this case earlier this week. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, walk us through what the plaintiffs are claiming in this federal lawsuit. What do they see as being violated here?
They, of course, they brought this in federal court. They're alleging civil rights violations. Basically on the grounds that Medicaid, as administered by the state here in Wisconsin, is unfairly denying what they consider and their doctors consider medically necessary treatment, and that's treatment to further confirm their gender identities. And they say that violates the 14th Amendment's equal protection and due process protections, as well as the Affordable Care Act provisions and other parts of federal health care law.
So the plaintiffs are Cody Flack of Green Bay and Sarah Ann McKenzie of Baraboo. Help us understand their stories, who they are.
The lawsuit, the complaint includes quite a bit about their stories, actually. Each has been, first of all, I'm sure that they had to be screened quite a bit to be withstanding, you know, the kind of attention you'll get by filing a suit like this. But anyway, each is Cody is a transgender male. He said he first identified as a boy, really, as young as 5 or 6 years old. And he began trying to change over as a teenager, and he lived in Pennsylvania. But oddly, he found that it wasn't until he moved to Green Bay that he found more acceptance to that. So he sped up the process. He officially changed his name, you know, got a male haircut, began dressing male. The typical steps that people will take when they're transitioning. And he, interestingly enough, in 2016, you know, he's doing all this while he's got other disabilities. He's got cerebral palsy, uses a motorized wheelchair. His only income is SSI, you know, disability income. And around 2016, he has a hysterectomy. And that, oddly enough, even though that is something that he may have pursued later as gender-conforming surgery to treat his gender dysphoria, it was covered by Medicaid because the reason for it was other complications that he was having at the time.
Yeah.
So that was a big step, and he felt that it helped him. And now he got to the point where he was trying to reach some kind of chest reconstruction to feel more male and appear male. And that was when he was denied. So he's left at that stage. The other woman, she has been in Wisconsin all her life and did similar steps to transition to her, to conform her gender identity as a female. Had all her documents changed, birth certificate changed, living as a female, and she got to the point where she wanted to take more of the steps of surgery. She was denied under the Medicaid rule here in Wisconsin. She actually borrowed $5,000 from her bank to pay for breast enhancement, or like a surgery to change her chest to become more female in appearance. And it's very tough for her to pay it back because she's also on SSI as her only income.
So in the denial of coverage, the state cited a rule that grouped medical care related to gender transition with cosmetic procedures like tattoo removal or earlobe repair. Why would these surgeries get lumped in here?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, it's a long list. The lawsuit refers to the list that's under the regulation as the exclusion clause or something. It lists all these other things that aren't covered, things like even autopsy is one of them. It's an interesting list. Some of them people probably would say, oh, that makes sense. You wouldn't see that Medicaid should cover that. But others that are covered by the same exclusion are anything related to fertility, like fertility research or fertility enhancement. It's also not covered by state Medicaid rule. So it's kind of broad ranging, and I think some of it, like I said, some of it to a layperson who's not a doctor seems to make sense at first glance. Some doesn't, and some might be cost related. Except the lawsuit points out that even when this rule was adopted in 97, groups that advised the legislature about fiscal impact said there's really not a factor for this. I mean, only because of the numbers, I think. There aren't that many people. There's only an estimated 20,000 transgender Wisconsin residents. Obviously, a much smaller number of them would be eligible for Medicaid. And not every transgender resident is going to seek this kind of surgery. Not everybody takes all the same steps to conform their gender identity. So as a fiscal reason, is not even when it was passed, that was not the given reason. Like, it's going to be too expensive for us to cover this.
We're talking with Bruce Valmetti. He covers legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, wrote a piece about this federal lawsuit brought by two transgender Wisconsinites, brought a federal lawsuit against the state's health department this week. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the federal lawsuit claiming that Wisconsin denies necessary treatment for transgender Medicaid patients? You can join in, email ideas@wpr.org. Bruce, the lawsuit names the defendants as the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, which administers Medicaid, and its secretary. How has the department responded?
Well, it's pretty typical for these things. They responded with, they can't respond, is what they said.
Yeah.
Every time there's litigation, a lot of public institutions, state, local government, county governments, tend not to say anything at all, citing, pending litigation. Not all of them do. Some respond, and they may yet. They'll eventually respond in writing to the lawsuit, but they have many days to do that. So at some point, we'll see their position on this.
Have we seen? Oh, go ahead.
Interestingly to note, a very similar challenge a few years ago in New York was quickly ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. And in that case, the state then quickly changed their rule and began covering this sort of treatment.
So it ended up changing the law.
It did in New York. And I think that's something they're going to ultimately wind up looking at and citing if need be. Although, like I said, in the New York case, at least, the administration in the state, once a judge said, this doesn't look good, this looks unconstitutional, they changed pretty quickly.
Is there any precedent for a case like this coming up before in Wisconsin?
A little bit. It's on different grounds and things, but I mentioned in the story that some years ago, actually the very, very specific point about whether this kind of gender-confirming surgery and treatment should be paid for by the state, but in a different way here, was among prisoners. Three transgender state prisoners sued because they were being denied treatment. That case also went to the Seventh Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court for Wisconsin and two other states, which ruled in the inmates' favor. But that case was a little different because it was under the Eighth Amendment. It was brought under withholding this was claimed to be cruel and unusual punishment.
Let's quickly bring in Kara joining us from Waukesha. Kara, hi. What are your thoughts on this?
Hi. I just wanted to say that I am a big supporter of, people that, make the decision to become transgender and want to identify and, find themselves out. I totally get all that. But I just feel like these people that are suing for this reason kind of, it doesn't make no sense to me, and it just seems a little ridiculous. And at the same time, I feel like they're almost making a bad name for the transgender community. Like, a lot of, I want to say maybe conservative people are going to be like, oh, really, this now? And, I mean, I just feel like we could be using our tax dollars to really help people with serious medical conditions, my fiancé being one of them, being denied Medicaid.
Kara, I have to cut you really short because we are really close to out of time. Bruce, your thoughts here as we wrap up.
I think that's a pretty typical, I think what Kara just said is probably a pretty common reaction to this news of the suit from people. And the plaintiff's lawyers say what they don't understand is that for these individuals, it is a very medically necessary thing.
And we have to stop right there. Bruce, thank you so much. Bruce Vilmedi covers legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. News is next here on the Ideas Network. The Trump administration says it plans to roll back a rule issued by President Obama that prevents doctors, hospitals, and health insurance companies from discriminating against transgender people. Advocates say it could jeopardize the significant gains that transgender people have seen in access to medical care, including gender reassignment procedures. We're turning our attention to healthcare now as we talk about being transgender in America today. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery at Mount Sinai in New York developed the first full-year fellowship to train physicians in gender-affirming surgery and gender-affirming psychiatric care. And medical students there can sign up for an elective to gain exposure to all areas of transgender health. Dr. Joshua Safer is executive director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery. He was born and raised in Milwaukee. He received his undergraduate degree from UW-Madison, and he earned his medical degree from the School of Medicine and Public Health at UW-Madison. He's an endocrinologist by training. Dr. Safer, welcome to the program, and welcome back to Wisconsin.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning.
Good morning. Can you start out by telling us your entry point about your work you do with transgender patients?
Absolutely. My roles as an endocrinologist eventually led me to being at Boston University in Boston at the medical school there. And in addition to some other areas of focus like thyroid and such, I had big teaching roles. And so a little over 10 years ago, I think wearing the hat of being an educator, I received patients who were considered not covered by others of our specialists, and that included the transgender patients. And specifically, I was supervising a fellow who took an interest, who then moved on to a faculty position and essentially left me with the patients, obliging me to get educated.
Well, there was the study, I think, in JAMA back in 2011 that found that showed that 5 was the mean number of LGBT-related content hours among 150 medical schools who completed a survey. Has the medical training caught up in the transgender area of medicine?
It has not. There's definite improvement. There's greater awareness among medical educators that there needs to be that education. But observe with that statistic that it's 5 hours of LGBT training in total. That doesn't necessarily even include transgender. Sometimes it does. And there's quite a bit to know. Transgender individuals, unlike others in the broader LGBT category, depend on medical providers who actually have some medical knowledge relating to transgender medicine. And so there is some training that needs to be integrated into medical curricula.
Can you step back for us and explain the difference between gender and sex for our listeners?
Certainly. Actually, it's funny because I jump right into trying to use the terminology correctly, especially because it's an evolution, and don't usually stop to define things. And ironically, some of the confusion comes from us in the field. So as a person who's into English, I'm not actually sure there is a difference between gender and sex, so this might be different than you were expecting me to say. I think those are synonyms. I think that those are just broad categories. Mm. We used to use sex just for living objects and gender for like parts of speech and such. But over the years, we've kind of adopted the the word gender to go with other things like gender identity, which is what somebody's sense of what their sex is, and other terms. So people sometimes say gender when I think they mean gender identity, and I think people use the word sex when they're talking about all the other body parts that are related to sex that you can see on somebody's body.
What percentage of American adults are transgender? Do we have firm numbers there?
We have various surveys of varying quality, and the numbers seem to be somewhere between 0.5% and 1%, depending how you define it. There are two elements. One is asking people if they feel they are transgender, and that gets you larger numbers. Then if you survey people who say they are transgender and ask if they are looking for medical intervention, then maybe about half of those who define themselves as transgender would actually want a medical intervention of some sort.
Well, we started the hour here talking about this lawsuit here in Wisconsin that really stems from a law in 1997 saying that basically gender reassignment surgery isn't necessary. How have you seen the medical care and the medical research evolve, especially as it relates to the laws on the books over the past 20 years or so?
Well, the big change in the medical community with regard to transgender medicine has been the recognition that gender identity is a durable biological phenomenon, or at least there's a substantial biology underlying it. And that just totally changes our thinking, and I'm happy to go into detail for...
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
So we have enough data from our attempts over, let's say, the last half century or a little bit more to try to make people change their gender identity to know that we cannot actually make people change their gender identity. There is something hardwired. And so I could go over some of those specific examples, but that's one category of data, and another category of data includes twin studies. The closer your DNA, the more likely it is that you would be transgender. So if I have a transgender individual who is an identical twin, that identical twin has about a 40% chance of being transgender, whereas if I have a transgender person with a non-identical, with a fraternal twin, that person, so far we don't see those people typically being transgender. And then to give perspective, 40% is a very high number. People think identical means identical, but it does not. Example being type 1 diabetes, which we have traced a very, very narrow genetic connection, and that if you have type 1 diabetes, you're an identical twin, your identical twin has about a 50% chance of having type 1 diabetes. So that would be kind of a standard thing among identical twins. So 40% fits that well. Point being, the closer your DNA, even accounting for the fact that they had the same parents, everything is the same with most of these twins in these studies. If you have, if your DNA is more the same, greater chance of being transgender, suggesting again there's a biological element to it.
So the research has advanced a lot in the past few decades, but there is still a lot to learn. But there is also this terminology around gender dysphoria. Help us understand what that is.
For many, many years, the medical community thought of people being transgender as suffering from a mental health concern that would be best treated in a mental health fashion. And I think many people in society actually still think that. In fact, many medical people still think that until at least there's an opportunity to educate them. Now, within conventional medical circles, that we recognize that gender identity is a biological phenomenon, we we move away, we recognize that this is not a mental health concern, that this is a true biological mismatch, as it were, between gender identity and some of the other body parts that we associate with somebody's sex, including specifically the parts that you can see externally. When we were calling it a mental health disorder, we were giving it mental health labels. An old label was gender identity disorder, and the psychiatric, the big North American psychiatric group that writes their big textbook of diagnoses called DSM, changed from gender identity disorder to gender dysphoria, which is kind of a fraught term, I think, at this point. They meant transgender. I think in the future, even gender dysphoria goes away, or it just gets limited to mean those people who are actually suffering a dysphoria from the disconnect. But if you're transgender and you don't, you don't have to be sad if you're transgender. You could just know that you're transgender and maybe want your hormones and not have a dysphoria.
Dr. Joshua Safer is with us. He heads the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. Gathering your questions, your personal stories, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you raising a transgender child? What has your experience been? What have you learned? Are you in the medical field? How has the conventional wisdom about transgender patients changed? Were you taught one thing in med school only to have research in later years confirm something very different? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Kayla, who's waiting in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Kayla.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
So I'm a transgender individual, and I'm married to another transgender individual. And we live right on the border of Wisconsin and Illinois, on the Illinois side. That it's horrible that the state coverage doesn't cover this. My insurance actually does cover it in Illinois. Under law, it's discrimination to not cover gender confirmation surgery.
And Kayla, when you say it, you mean the surgeries that are involved. Can you be more specific, if possible?
Well, I am male to female, and my husband is female to male. Bottom surgery lower genital surgery is covered under my insurance through my job. Also, I don't think breast augmentation is covered for male to female, but I believe that it is covered breast reduction surgery, like mastectomy for a female to male. And now I'm using those terms to kind of make it easier for people to understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and
I always considered myself female, but since I was a little kid, I thought like a female, and I am a female. I'm, taking hormones for the past 2 years, and I'm in my 40s. So it took a long time to actually pull the trigger on it, but it's made my life 100 times better to actually live and feel comfortable in my own skin and not have other people, including, myself, when I look in the mirror, see somebody that's not me looking back at me. So that's, it's really important for a transgender person to have congruency, to, feel comfortable and not feel out of place, have other people see you as you instead of, seeing something that your brain is disconnected with.
Kayla, thank you so much for your willingness to tell your story. Some things sticking out here, Dr. Safer, the congruency, and Kayla really explaining that it's complicated. There are gaps in medical coverage here.
Thank you, Kayla. Kayla brought up a number of important points. It has taken a while for the establishment medicine even to recognize that there is this incongruence and that this is a biological phenomena, that whatever genes code for your gender identity might usually code for the body parts that we all kind of associate with that, but it's not clearly always the case. In terms of the coverage, I can get into that a tiny little bit. In the establishment medical community, once we go there, once we say, oh, this is biology, and then we start to think, oh, well, as scientists, as biologists, as physicians, what is it that we can do for people in this circumstance? And in 2018, the data are that the thing that works best for those people looking for medical interventions is to change the body, that is the physical appearance, to match gender identity, or at least that's the typically best circumstance. Not 100%. That's typically done with hormones and perhaps with surgeries, depends on the individual. If that's so, then this simply should be a standard medical coverage that is part of our of what we provide as part of our standard medical system. That's the view, I think, pretty much across the board in conventional medicine these days. It sounds like her experience in Illinois is typical of many states where to step outside science and to suggest that a medical treatment not be made available to a particular group is just purely discrimination.
Dr. Safer, how is coverage in the area of hormone therapy? Because I, as I was prepping here and reading, I came across the article where a transgender woman was able to breastfeed after the hospital had induced lactation, and that a regimen of drugs helped that process. So where are we at with hormone therapy and coverage?
So two things there. With regard to hormones are very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. Primary care is inexpensive. Endocrinology is inexpensive. Mental health is inexpensive. So even before there was broad coverage by insurance companies in many states, many insurance companies were they just did not pay attention to hormone coverage, and people could get some hormone coverage. Basically, it wasn't worth it to the insurance company to go investigate. It would be like trying to screen for aspirin. So that's as far as hormone coverage. Now, as we recognize the biological reality, and we recognize that the most common medical treatment in order to get appearance to match gender identity is hormones, certainly those states, I would say it would be discriminatory not to allow.
Yeah.
It would be discriminatory to block coverage, are going to insist on hormone coverage. And insurance companies are not exactly worrying about that because it costs them nothing. The paper of filling out the forms is more expensive than the medication itself sometimes.
Dr. Joshua Safer is with us. He heads up the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. Your questions, your stories are welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you transgender? Did you grow up in a time when transgenderism wasn't well understood? What was that like? What do people most often get wrong about transgender people today? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll continue the conversation after the latest news here on the Ideas Network. Estimates of the number of transgender people here in the U.S., it's somewhere between 1 million and 1.4 million. It's quite plausible that most physicians will have transgender patients at some point as part of their practice. Medical students and residents are asking for more curriculum about how to care for transgender patients. We're talking about the state of healthcare for transgender people here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Endocrinologist Joshua Safer is our guide. He's executive director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. Getting your questions and experiences this hour as well at 800-642-1234. Are you transgender? What do people most often get wrong about transgender people? What does the medical establishment need to know? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Safer, before we went to the break, you had wanted to make one more point there, and I cut you off short on, I think, hormone therapy, because I also had brought up this case with a transgender woman able to breastfeed with the help of a certain regimen of drugs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorry about that. I guess the news has to go on. I just want to comment there, because that actually happened here at Mount Sinai in New York, and that just represents an entire area where we clearly have more to learn. It makes sense. There is, when transgender women develop breasts, the breast tissues seem to be normal, and so it seems reasonable that could actually happen. I want to be clear, the regimen included medication which is not FDA approved for use in the United States, and so the hospital didn't actually prescribe the regimen. The woman actually brought the regimen from Canada, took it, and the hospital's role was primarily making sure she and the baby were staying safe while she was doing this, regardless of what anybody here at the hospital was actually prescribing to her. But nonetheless, and impressively, the overall regimen did really result in her producing sufficient breast milk, 8 ounces by the time the baby was born, and then more presumably over time, that this fed the baby, and the baby developed normally for the first 6 weeks of life. After that point, she switched to formula, I think maybe to be conservative or to be safe. But the bottom line, it's true, and we, because we could document it, certainly put it out there as something interesting to know about and to study in the future.
Yeah, what did we learn from this case study?
What we learned is that somehow the breasts that develop from hormones, what we learned is what we suspected, which is that hormones really affect your breast growth, regardless of how your body began. And if you have your hormone profile shifted to a female range and develop breasts, those breasts can have normal breast tissue on the inside that produces presumably normal milk, or certainly what looks like normal milk that has in volumes that can support a baby.
Let's bring in Anne waiting in Chippewa Falls. Anne, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to start out saying thank you so very much for having this conversation, for doing the research, and also for your work.
Oh, Anne, you're breaking up. Yeah, keep going. Oh. Okay, you're better now.
Sorry. just wanted to really express appreciation for all that you're doing. I am the parent of a transgendered young man, and have found that we have so many issues with the general population not understanding that this is a biological issue, not a choice that someone is making. The other comment and partial question that I have that I'm hoping you will address is the nature of the higher level of suicide for individuals who are untreated as transgendered individuals. And so I would love to have your comments on that.
Anne, thank you. Dr. Safer, go ahead.
Anne, thank you. That's a huge point, which is that if we fail to treat people for this incongruence, so one, they're living with it, and two, I think we make it worse by mistreating people in addition, then we're looking at suicide and suicide attempts historically reported among transgender individuals of maybe 40% up to maybe a half, which is just enormous. Notably, among younger transgender individuals living in a society with a greater appreciation for the fact that this is biology, and having an opportunity to actually be treated, then that levels of depression and suicide begin to look much more like they look for all of us in general society. So really a huge, terrible situation that does not have to be that way.
Dr. Safer, what advice do you have for a parent of a transgender child?
I think there are two things that come to mind. One is, because this is biology, there need not be any anxiety about simply going with what the child wants to do, something we call gender expression, or some people call this social transition. If your child says, I am a boy or I am a girl, opposite to what you had been expecting based on body parts, there is no real reason why you can't simply go with the flow, as it were, and learn from the child. And the child will tell you what to do as things evolve in their mind and as they make their determination how they're going to deal with the circumstance. You need not worry, like I think some parents might, that you might accidentally brainwash your child into being transgender. You can't do that. If we could brainwash people into changing their gender identity, we would have succeeded in the reverse, in forcing people to have their gender identity match their body parts, which is not working. So you needn't be nervous about that, and I think you can be relaxed about that. On the other hand, in this world, I think you still want to look out and make sure that there are safe environments for your child at school and such, and that the community is well educated. I think education ends up being very helpful in terms of people getting it into their brain what the logical thing might be in terms of how they should be dealing with kids. For what it's worth, we had a transgender girl that is male to female in my children's grade school, and the school made quite a large event out of the child announcing that she was a girl, fourth, fifth grade, something like that, and brought in mental health counselors to help everybody and educators, and it was exclusively for the parents. That is, my child, who was in a different grade, said to me, representative, I think most of the student body, oh, everybody already knows that.
That's older. What's the big deal?
Exactly.
But that takes a whole lot of trust on the part of the parent to allow the child to take that lead and make those types of decisions. Those are big decisions.
They are. And like I said already, if this is biology, then someone can feel relatively safe. Important to know, too, we don't use medicines on small children. That is, there is no hormone difference between boys and girls before they hit puberty. And so there really isn't anything but clothing and haircuts that changes. So nothing too permanent here when you're thinking about, quote-unquote, big decisions. Mm. Nothing irreversible. And the first medications we institute for kids in puberty are what we call puberty blockers that just simply, it's a regimen we use for kids who go into puberty too early. We've been doing this for decades. But we can do this for transgender kids just the same. It's very reversible. And so if we're worried that we're going too far too fast, we can simply do this for the child so that they don't suffer with the wrong puberty, but know that regardless of how this turns out, all will be fine. We can allow the child to follow the puberty that that their body parts would naturally have happened, or we can provide the hormones that are necessary for the puberty to match gender identity, if that proves to be what's going to be the pathway. And so that, too, is very reversible and is not an area of concern. And it's really only mid high school, late high school, on into adulthood, where we get into actual hormones with some irreversible effects, or even some surgeries. So there's time, I guess. So that's another thing. It's a big decision, but it occurs over a long time. And at the beginning, there aren't actually big decisions.
Let's go to Liz waiting in Green Bay. Hi, Liz.
Good morning, and I also wanted to express my appreciation for this program. My niece is transgender from male to female, and talking earlier about the insurance, her insurance did cover the lower surgery, and for the her breasts, the whole family agree or disagree with her decision, pitched in to cover the deductible for the lower surgery and the breast augmentation. And I just wanted to say that she is a completely different person. She has flourished in every way. And as a family, we could not be more pleased with the results of her decision. And I just wanted to say that the biggest misconception that came about was that the confusion of her sex versus her sexuality. Mm. It had nothing to do with her sexual preference and everything to do with who she felt she was or is.
Liz, thank you so much. And as we wrap up the hour here, Dr. Safer, your thoughts?
Yeah, Liz, excellent. That's another enormous point, which is one of my instructors years ago said that gender identity, sexual orientation is who you want to go to bed with, and gender identity is who do you want to go to bed as. Mm. And I think that just summarizes transgender people. It's just who they are. Certainly the relationships in which they're interested are a completely different subject entirely.
Well, Dr. Safer, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, really my pleasure, Kate. Thank you very much.
That was Milwaukee native Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery. Started the hour with Bruce Velmetti, who covers legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Chasso, and the Ideas Network Director, Cheryl Gasser. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.